Welcome everyone to episode 71 of Underserved. Today, joining me in studio is Dr. Colleen Tarto, Director of Engineering at Starburst Data. Let's get started.
Welcome to this week's edition of Underserved, the podcast for the rest of the tech industry, where we focus on stories of tech industry leaders, their insights, and their lessons learned. And now, your host, Andrew Jalina.
Colleen, thank you so much for coming down and joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Andrew. It's great to be here.
So what first got you interested in technology? Like, were you fooling around with any stuff in high school that sparked an interest?
It was actually my parents bought our first computer. And I remember learning BASIC and thinking it was really cool that I could do a little bit of ASCII art and a little bit of basic for looping and mocking my brother with the for loops, that kind of thing. And it was super fun and just kind of sparked it for me.
What were your favorite subjects when you were in high school?
Math, science, and French.
Okay. I don't know French, but I do know a bit about math and science. Yeah. Like, what did you like in particular? Did you go towards a particular branch of science?
Yeah, I always loved physics. And I was like that physics nerd who was reading all the popular science books and, you know, Stephen Hawking and Carl Sagan. And I really enjoyed that. And I always followed astronomy and the space industry as well. I always really liked that. And I liked how it was all based on math. And that was really what formed science.
And so did that inform where you went to school for college or what you did?
Not really. I actually, my brother had gone to Colby College where I went, and that was kind of like, oh, I should go there. And people were like, don't you want to go to MIT? I was like, nah, why don't be off in the woods? I think that'd be fun. So I went to Colby and it was a pretty simple decision for me. You know, I didn't spend too much time on that decision, but it was great because when I got there, I realized, hey, I can be a physics major. And hey, people study astronomy. That's really cool. And they had an observatory and there were just two of us studying astronomy. So we basically shared this like private small observatory and learned, you know, how to work an observatory and how all of the computers at the observatory worked and how to write programs to process the data and stuff. So it was like my earliest foray into data management and data processing.
So they have this observatory. There's a telescope looking at the stars. It's got a camera hooked up to it. Mm-hmm. How does it know how to track things as they go across the sky?
Well, it turns out that's a very constant motion. So it can very easily track the sky. Like most moderately sophisticated telescopes and above have automatic sky tracking. So you can focus on one object and then stay on that while you absorb the photons into the camera.
And so all that comes down, like, what do you do with the data once you have it?
That's the fun part, right? It's data processing. It's analytics at its heart. And I mean, I didn't realize that, but you have to clean it. You have to subtract out all of the photons that you don't intend to study. So, you know, ambient light from the football field nearby or the city of Tucson. Or so you subtract out all of that light. And then what's left is the universe. And you get to look at that and sort of study it and try to understand it, whether you're taking a flat image of a beautiful picture of the sky or you're taking a spectrum so you can actually study the makeup of light you're looking at.
And then you kind of assign colors to the different gases so you can tell what's what.
Yeah. So for me, it was mostly looking at absorption spectra. When I got to graduate school, that's what I studied was sodium absorption spectrum. So basically, you're looking at a light source and then your light is being absorbed by dust and gas between the light source and you. And so you're looking for the absence of specific kinds of light, which tells you that that sort of atom is there. So in the case I was looking for, it was mostly sodium. So looking at sodium in the universe.
Now, it's been a long time since freshman year when I took astronomy, but I think I remember the universe is expanding.
It is. You know, we're pretty sure we understand how fast it's expanding. The question is it accelerating or decelerating? Are things getting farther and farther apart forever? Or is there going to be a big crunch where it basically slows down, stops, and starts coming together again? TBD on that. You know, I guess we'll figure it out eventually, but it's pretty cool.
Now, you finish up with a BA in physics. What do you decide to do after that?
Basically, in my mind, I decided to go to graduate school because I didn't really know what else to do at that point. But I really loved research and I loved teaching. And so that's what you do in grad school. And I had studied masers, which are microwave lasers. And so that was something that I was really interested in continuing to study in UC Santa Barbara. I had a colleague there who I had been on a paper with. And so I went there to study with him. And then after a few years, I decided to switch over to observational optical astronomy, actually studying optical light instead of radio waves.
And so where are the telescopes that you're using for this stuff?
This is where it all sounds like a scam. So I used telescopes on Hawaii. I used Keck telescope for most of my thesis and also Lick Observatory outside of San Jose in California.
That you went to Puerto Rico too, right?
Yes, I also went to Puerto Rico, which is Arecibo Observatory.
And then a little time in New Mexico?
Yeah, I worked at the Very Large Array. New Mexico is so different than New England, where I grew up, that it was really interesting living out there and just seeing such a different part of the states and experiencing something totally different than where I had grown up.
Now you're in Socorro?
I was.
That's for those who haven't been to New Mexico, it's about an hour and a half south of Albuquerque. Amazing Mexican food and kind of on the way to Roswell.
It is. And I have been to Roswell and it's fun. It's super fun. I do believe in extraterrestrial life. I don't believe in little green men walking the streets of New Mexico, but it was still super fun going there.
I have been to Roswell as well. I definitely recommend if you're in New Mexico, southeastern New Mexico, you might as well swing by, check out the A. Lee Inn and the museum and all that stuff.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of fun stuff in southern New Mexico. There's White Sands. There's also a solar observatory in Alamogordo. There's beautiful mountains. There's really interesting landscapes. It's very fun to spend a summer there and just be outside.
You told me an interesting factoid that while pursuing your PhD, it was only $13 to get your master's too.
Yeah, so I was not in a terminal master's program. I was in a PhD program. So if you decided to leave the program and you had done your qualifying exams and your initial thesis idea was getting going, you could get the terminal master's if you wanted to leave. But I think at one point I was filing some paperwork and they said, do you want to pay and get your master's? And I was like, that's fine. Sure. I was like, how much? And they said $13. And so basically for the fancy piece of paper that's now framed on my wall.
Still seems like a good deal.
Yeah, the PhD, I think, cost $20-something. But my PhD was signed by Arnold Schwarzenegger because he was the governor of California at the time.
The governator.
You are listening to the Underserved Podcast. Underserved is produced by Syrinx, the developer-founded, developer-run software consulting company. For more information, visit Syrinx.com. That's Syrinx.com.
So you're going through these programs, you realize that graduate advisors have 10 students and maybe one astronomer.
Took me long enough, but I did step back and look at the data and I realized, you know, my advisor has, you know, some large number of students every year graduating and she's still there. She's not abandoning her post. And so most schools have 1 to 5 astronomers unless they're a big astronomy program. And so I saw the people who were graduating before me and they were ending up in places they didn't want to live. They were in postdocs year after year after year. And this was in the midst of the bubble that preceded the 2008 financial crisis. And so I could kind of see where the writing on the wall. And I was like, first thing to go is probably going to be astronomy postdocs. So I made the decision to take a break, really. And I wasn't sure what I wanted to do, but I had been working nonstop since college. I never took time off between college and grad school. And so I decided I deserved a break.
So where'd you go?
Europe. I had a conference in Leiden in the Netherlands, which is absolutely gorgeous town. And then I met up with some friends and traveled. And then those friends went home and other friends arrived. And I basically traipsed around Europe for 3 months. Something like that until I ran out of money and moved back in with my parents.
That's a good run. What else did you see besides the Netherlands while you were there?
I did a lot of fun stuff. I went to Italy. I had a friend living at Pisa. I had another friend working at CERN. So I basically hung out with all of my physics nerd friends.
Did you get this picture in Pisa where you're holding up the tower?
I did. And I did the smushing the Eiffel Tower. I remember my friends and I went, we were in Zurich and I have a dear friend who lives there, Stefan, and he's a chef. And my other friend is a cheesemonger. And so, you know, we basically just ate our way around Switzerland. But we went up to the mountains in the Alps and we walked through a glacier. There's like some mountain that you can just like go up on a gondola and a funicular and it's very high up and you like walk through a glacier, which was really fun.
That's cool.
Yeah.
So all good things must come to an end. You run out of money. You come home.
My parents were like, you know, you're 28. You might want to think about getting a job.
Okay. So yeah. Where do you get a job?
I knew I wanted to live in, you know, the Boston, Cambridge area, and I needed a job that I could afford to do that. And I kept saying, I'll never go into software, because to me, software meant sitting in front of a computer coding day in and day out. I just didn't understand the ecosystem that goes into a software company, because I had only done development on my own in graduate school, where I was my own sysadmin. I bought the Sun computer and I set it up myself and installed Linux. And, you know, I didn't understand that it's very different at a professional software company. I was looking at a lot of other things around academia, but then a recruiter cold called me saying, come talked to the software company and he couldn't really tell me much about it. And I said, this sounds like a mafia front, frankly. He somehow convinced me to come in and have lunch. And so I came in and I had lunch and I ended up working at that company for 7 years.
What company was that?
Ab initio in Lexington, Massachusetts.
So you can say the name.
Yes, I can say the name. And I loved it there. And it's a really wonderful company. They make ETL software. So that's really their core focus. Yeah, I learned so much. I was a field engineer. I was a support engineer. I, you know, did documentation. I did some development. I got to do a little bit of everything, which was really fun.
Were you face-to-face with customers at all? Doing like implementations or?
Yeah, I can't talk about all the different projects I did, but I will say that I got to work on some really complex and really important pieces of software that you probably touch every day.
Yeah, they have a bunch of customers in a bunch of different industries, right?
Yes, yes. It's definitely in all different verticals, which is really fun for me. And so that was my first exposure to enterprise software because the cloud wasn't a thing yet. And so, you know, SaaS and managed services weren't really where they are today.
So they grow pretty rapidly, but the field wasn't even called data engineering yet. You know, like What do you kind of say, okay, I think I've taken this as far as I can? Like, what makes you want to move on?
I reached an inflection point for myself where I felt like I had a handle on ab initio. I felt like I was the expert in a certain number of areas and I was having fun and I enjoyed the company, but I wanted to see what people were doing with the data. And I think I probably jumped into that a little bit early, but this was sort of the era of everybody wanted to started talking about machine learning and data science. Everybody wanted to do data science. And so I went to a consulting firm called AlixPartners. And we wanted to build a data science lab in our Boston office. And the idea was that it would be a hosted lab where people would send their data and we would write models. And we hired a bunch of data scientists and PhDs in stats. And we would have this service where it would be machine learning as a service, essentially. And I think that idea was before its time. Like, it really just comes back to the data. And I think that's still true today. Like, if your data is not in adequate shape, if it's not clean, if it's not consistent, if it's not reliable, you'll never be able to do data science. So you can do analytics, though. So that's actually where we ended up going, was mostly analytics and visual analytics, which was really fun.
While you're there, they say, all right, well, if you're going to become a VP and stay one, you got to carry a bag, right?
Yeah, it was a lot of travel. And that was around when I had my older son and just having a baby, you know, we just bought a house traveling. It was just a lot. And I sort of made the conscious decision that I didn't want to travel. And that was a struggle at that company because, you know, management consulting is all about traveling. And so they tried and I tried to make it work. But this was a really interesting project that we did about unclaimed property. So there's this huge industry of unclaimed property. So I worked on that, basically a consulting project where we just had access to what they call the death file. So it's actually the file of everybody who's died in the US. And you can actually like look people up. Like I looked up my grandparents, right? And it's literally by social security number. It's obviously incredibly protected. You have to have a very specific type of account in order to access that file. You have to have specific security restrictions around your environment. But we did this huge unclaimed property project and we were able to recover money for people. And we were hired by the states because if people can't claim it, then the states get it. And that's how they fund things. So it was a really interesting project. But again, like they just wanted me to travel. I wasn't into it. So in the end, I chose to leave there and I wanted to find something where I could really focus on my leadership skills because that was something I was able to do at AlixPartners, but I wanted to build that out more and focus on the end-to-end product and really own something in a way that you can't do when you're a consultant. Because you're a consultant, you come in, you tell them your great idea, maybe you help implement it, and then you leave. So I wanted to like stick around and own something.
And so do you move back into doing software at a software company?
Yes. So then I went back to a B2B company, Veracode. And that was a really interesting company. It's still right down the road in Burlington, Massachusetts. And it's a cybersecurity company. So the idea is that when you're developing software, instead of waiting to get breached because it turns out you had a vulnerability, you scan it ahead of time and look for potential vulnerabilities and fix them before the software goes into production. And the idea is that customers of Veracode, say a security group leader would say, okay, how are we doing? Are we getting better? Are we getting worse? How many kinds of flaws do we have? And, you know, what are the analytics behind that? And so what my team built provided reporting to start. And then we built out an entire end-to-end environment where we had data engineering so that we were pulling data from a lot of different places and then providing analytics in an embedded tool within the Veracode SaaS platform. So I worked with full stack engineers. I worked with data engineers. I worked with analysts. It was great. I got to do pretty much everything and architect that with my team. And they were really wonderful.
I will give Veracode the underserved, undeserved endorsement. Undeserved because they are not paying me for it. But we used it on a couple engagements for clients, and it was a great product as far as scanning vulnerabilities. They give you a nice UI to see what are the severe ones, what are the less severe ones.
Yeah.
And you're basically just trying, you know, like a Jira or something to drive it to bug zero.
There's a Jira plugin, so you can have it like the flaw becomes a Jira ticket for your team to solve and things like that. It's a really great product. And so I felt really good about what we built there. And I'm still in touch with the people from there. And yeah, we use Veracode today at Starburst.
I am altering the scope of the project. Pray I don't alter it any further.
Excellent. Let the scope creep flow. Keep adding features.
To deploy the release,
deliver first. You must.
I find your lack of faith in change management disturbing.
Missing your deadline is the path to the dark side.
If you or someone you know manages software development projects, we can help. Call the offices of Syrinx Consulting. Syrinx provides software consultants who hit the ground running to help you deliver right away. Our toll-free number is 888-579-7469, option 1. Or you can live chat with Berg at Syrinx.com. That's Syrinx.com.
Syrinx is not a law office and this is not legal advice. Offer valid only in the United States. Hablamos español, pero solo un poco y no tener ni pies ni cabeza. Saludos.
So you did a bunch of projects there. You said we delivered and I delivered. Had another child.
I did. I had my second son who's now almost 4.
From there, quick pit stop at EasyCater for a little while.
I wanted to try something cloud native. That was really what I was looking for. I wanted to use Snowflake. I had heard so much about it. And we had all these grand plans for revamping their data and analytics ecosystem and the architecture underneath it. And, you know, I have a wonderful team there that we had hired and built out. It was all going swimmingly until the pandemic hit. And it turns out that in a pandemic, people don't want catering.
Really?
They don't want large trays of communal food when they're wiping down their groceries. So I was laid off from there and, you know, it's fine though. It was a good experience.
But you fell into quite a good thing at Starburst Data where you are now.
Yeah. And so what happened with Starburst is I had been leading data engineering teams and analytics teams. And for me, it always came back to the data. Like data engineering is really where my heart was because the analytics is cool. And like there's great visualization tools out there. There's wonderful machine learning tools that I think are maturing now with MLOps and all of that coming down the pike. But for me, it all came back to the data. Like if you can't access the data, if there's latency, if the data pipelines break, it's always a problem. And I was looking for my next role. And, you know, most of the jobs were at various stages of maturity, but it was all predicated around this idea of moving data away from the source in order to do analytics or data science on it, which I'm just like, why are we doing this?
Well, it's always the, oh, you can't report on the transactional data. You'll keel over production.
Because you used to have these OLTP databases and you couldn't treat it like an OLAP database, right? So you had to move it somewhere else and build your OLAP cube. I think the thing that was interesting for me was when I was at Veracode and a couple of other places, I had heard about this technology called Presto that Facebook had invented and open sourced. And I had heard of that technology and I was like, oh, that's really cool. But like for whatever reason, we just never used it. Although I think it certainly could have been applicable at a couple of places I worked. And so when I was contacted by a recruiter about Starburst, first of all, I laughed because I had worked at Starburst Galaxies for my PhD. So I said, oh, well, that's hilarious because it sounds like kismet, right?
I'll tell you about Starburst.
I know. And then when I talked to folks at Starburst, I was like, oh, I see what they're doing. So they were using what was Presto, what's now Trino, but it's the open source product that Facebook had created, and they're using that and commercializing it and making it an enterprise product. And then we also have a managed service. So I was brought in to lead a couple of the engineering teams on that. And so I've switched from being the consumer to now being the vendor in a lot of ways, which is interesting, but I think it gives me a unique perspective.
The problem it's tackling, everyone has it. Like, I just want to leave my data where it is and then layer something on top of it and be able to report and not have to ship it and dump it to a hard drive and FedEx it somewhere or, God forbid, try and push it through the internet. Like, I just want to leave it where it is and figure out things. So how does that work?
It makes a lot of sense when you think about it, because I can't count the number of times I've been woken up by PagerDuty because a data pipeline broke. It's like, why are we still doing this? It's 2022. Let's like step back and think about what we're really doing. And so the idea of leaving the data where it is frankly genius. It's genius and elegant in its simplicity. And so Starburst has the creators of Presto, now Trino, working at Starburst, all of the creators of it. You know, I truly believe in what we're building, which is nice. It's always good to be motivated by the work you're doing.
And then I imagine you guys can run on-prem or in the cloud or...
Yeah. And like I said, we have a managed service. So if you're a cloud native, like, we run on AWS, Azure, and GCP. And then I run the engineering department for that. And the enterprise offering can literally run anywhere, like bare metal, the cloud, or anywhere in between. And it can run in a hybrid fashion too, which is really powerful.
Now, you mentioned that you have some mentors finally at Starburst.
So I found it challenging to find. I've been part of mentoring programs where you're like assigned a mentor. I never felt that was particularly effective because I feel like it needs to happen a little bit more organically. And so I am part of a mentoring program called Plato, where I am a mentor for budding engineering leaders. And that's been really special for me. And then also over the past few years, I've had some people who have, you know, come into my life. And at the time, I don't know that I realized that they were mentoring me, but I think that I took it as coaching, and, you know, I really appreciate their opinions. So, you know, one is Jess Iandiorio, our CMO. I really value her perspective. And it's not just that she's a woman on our exec team at Starburst, but also like her perspective is just really valuable to me in things around like building a personal brand and like how that dovetails with your brand at your company. I also have been part of a speaking boot camp for women that I met a lot of really valuable people who have come in and helped shape who I am as a speaker and how I present myself and things like that. One of the women at that boot camp and I, we were both like the two data nerds. A lot of people were talking about disparate topics, and she and I both were talking about data. So we kind of gravitated towards each other. We actually started a newsletter called The Sequel, where it's thesequel.substack.com, and you can go there and read our thoughts on the human side of data. So pontificate about data mesh, or she has a great article about Snowbricks and Dataflake and how the two products are merging towards each other, which is really fun. And then, you know, I have a product manager that I worked with years ago at Veracode, and now she and I are still friends, and she's been a wonderful partner, and I think she and I mentor each other, which is really wonderful. So, and then obviously our CEO, Justin, is, you know, I want to be him when I grow up. So
tell us a bit about Justin.
Justin's amazing. This is his second startup. And the way he sees the market is really impressive. Like, he understands the market deeply, but he knows what he's doing when it comes to like running a startup and coming up with plans and things like that. And then the culture that we have at Starburst is really something special. We focus on character and competency and ownership. And it's that ownership that I really like. And we talk about being a meritocracy. And I think as a woman, I realize that a meritocracy can be a bit of a toxic thing because it assumes that opportunity is equally distributed, much like talent, which I don't think it is. But that said, I think it's an interesting ideal. And the idea of rewarding people for hard work is really interesting to me. And I really resonate with that.
In a previous episode of Underserved, Nasheen Mulana talked about being a woman in engineering and having to kind of coach herself and psych herself up to be able to put forth those ideas and not be afraid of being wrong or possibly quieting down that person who won't stop talking in the meeting in order to get that idea out there. Is that a similar experience?
It's not malicious, but the number of men who have taken my ideas and presented them as their own or spoken over me in meetings, I mean, it's led to a character trait that my husband drives him nuts, right? Where I interrupt him and he's like, why are you interrupting me? I'm like, because I get interrupted if I don't do that, right? So I have to temper that at home. It can be challenging. I mean, you know, this industry is incredibly biased. And it's rooted in the industry itself, right? And it's, sure, you can trace it back all the way to education and, you know, the foundations of our society. But that said, I think we are an incredibly educated industry and that we can do better. And so when I see issues, I call them out. When I encounter those behaviors, I counteract them.
Yeah, I think for the most part, folks are done with the programmer days and like want to build a more inclusive, never mind from a moral or right perspective, just from a good business perspective. Like it's good to get all these different ideas and perspectives into the project and into the company.
The companies with more diversity, just looking at gender diversity, I realize there's other kinds of diversity, but obviously gender, it literally should be 50-50. So that's the biggest disparity, I think. But if you look at gender diverse companies, which have more females in leadership, those companies are more innovative. Like they make more new products, right? Which is something that is going to be better for your business. And I think there are a ton of counterexamples, things like Face ID initially only worked on white male faces, or go in the bathroom and the automatic soap dispenser only works on white skin, right? Like there's a lot of ways that like we can build better products if we just were more diverse. So I think, and from a business perspective, companies with more diverse leadership make more money.
So there's also a different kind of SQL at Starburst Data, the Space Quest League. What is this?
It is super fun. It's our sweepstakes. And we are running it all year long. And there's a different prize every quarter. This quarter, I wish I could win it because I really want this prize. The prize is a luxury Disney Galactic experience at the Star Wars Resort. I think it's worth something like $35,000. Like I desperately want this, someone to win this and take me with them. So it's free to enter. But the wonderful thing is that if you enter, we will donate $1 to charity.
That's cool.
Yeah.
And so what are like the little gamified tasks you have to do?
So there's a lot of fun questions about what company has the largest Hadoop cluster and a bunch of technical questions like what does the SQL do? And then some multiple choice answer. There's also some questions about astronomy that I put in there. And so for Black History Month in February, we put in a bunch of questions about Black astronomers and Black scientists and computer scientists. Now that it's Women's History Month in March, they're mostly focused on women scientists and computer scientists. And then I will put a little plug in. We did something special for May the 4th, just Star Wars Day. And we love that theme at Starburst. And so there will be some special videos coming out starring yours truly and one of my dear friends. I won't say anymore, but it's definitely worth watching.
Well, May the 4th be with you.
And also with you.
So when you actually pull your hands off keyboard, what do you do for fun or at least outside of work?
Well, like I said, I have two little boys, so they take up most of my time. Spend a lot of time running around with them. The older one's into Pokemon Go, which I think is great because now that the weather's nicer, we're able to run around town and go to a park and look for Pokemon. I've been writing a lot, though. My sort of pandemic hobby has been writing, and that took two forms. One is calligraphy, and I'd been following a calligrapher on Instagram for a really long time, and I decided, you know, it's pandemic, not spending money on anything else. I might as well do this. And it's been a really fun hobby. It's not a useful hobby at all, but you know, I do things like I write swear words really fancy and I put them on my wall and little mantras and things like that. I also like, you know, if it's somebody's birthday, I'll calligraphy them up a card or send a card to my son's teachers or something. But for the most part, it's just really relaxing for me. And it's been really good for me to get out of my headspace and like put on an audiobook and do some calligraphy, which is really fun.
Which course did you end up taking in order to get into it?
I've been following this woman on Instagram for a long time. It's crookedcalligraphy.com. And she's a former lawyer who quit to do calligraphy, which was super inspirational, actually. And she's got quite the successful business now.
When you get something that's like written so nicely in calligraphy, like it's impossible for it to not feel classy.
I mean, I'm classy. The calligraphy's classy. It's all classy.
So you mentioned you did some other writing as well, more traditionally with the keyboard.
Yes, more traditional. So this is hands back on keyboard. I have been writing both for Starburst and on my own. I mentioned the SQL, our blog. I've been in this business for long enough that I have a lot of opinions that I've formed. And it's been fun trying to articulate those in a way that I can, you know, have the conversation with others. And I'm not a huge Twitter user. I don't love to try to condense things down into 280 characters or 140 characters, but I do like to think of a solid way of explaining a complex topic to someone and getting their thoughts on it. And so that's been a really fun journey for me, has been writing on my own. And then also for Starburst, I've been writing a lot of different thought pieces and blogs with a colleague of mine about data mesh, which is the theory around decentralization of data management, which has been really fun. And then just some thought pieces around data.
Tell me quickly about data mesh. Pretend I know nothing, but have a technical background.
Sure. So basically, it's a way of thinking about how you architect, organize, and really drive your people around data. They call it a socio-technical construct around data. And it's the idea that instead of trying to get a single source of truth and sort of pipe all of your data to this central repository, and then that magically serves all of your downstream data needs, that paradigm has a lot of challenges because it's assuming that everyone can pipe the data in and that the data can magically be combined into this like one format that serves all downstream data needs. And that's just not feasible as your organization grows. And so the idea is that instead we should be focusing on trying to treat data as a product. And I think when people hear that, they're like, of course data is a product. But really what that means is you need to use product thinking around the data and think about your consumers as your customers, really making sure that the people who produce the data understand that the downstream use of their data is their responsibility. So it's got these four pillars, the first of which is the idea of domain oriented architecture and ownership. And then the second pillar is that they're producing data as a product. And then the third pillar is around a self-service architecture. And then the fourth pillar is around governance and the idea that you should have a federated governance model. So the domain is responsible for some of it and the organization is responsible for the rest of it. It's almost academic in some ways, but I will say that the idea of data as a product is the heart of it. And that is really important to me because as a data nerd, why wouldn't you want your data to be a product?
Well, you have company, Matt Hillery, also underserved guest, talked about data being a product at his company and kind of wrapping the culture and pieces around it that you need in order to make it that. So I'll be sure to tell him about your post.
Very cool. Very cool.
You still follow like astronomy things and rocket launches and telescopes and stuff like that?
I do. Most of the folks that I know from astronomy have moved on. We're largely in data and data science now. But I do have some folks that I used to work with at Harvard who are still on Twitter talking about rocket launches all the time and spacecraft launches. And so I follow them and I don't follow it as closely as I'd like, but I try.
So I loosely follow like SpaceX and what Elon Musk is up to. Mm-hmm. What do you think about his quest to make us an interplanetary species?
I'm torn about that because on the one hand, I value exploration. You know, I think it brings together the citizens of Earth in a way that a lot of things pull us apart. So like to think about our place in the universe is very important. And I think it's unifying, which is good. On the other hand, there are a lot of things we need to fix here. So the amount of money being spent on commercialized space travel right now, where I don't think it's actually helping us towards that goal of being an interplanetary species and it's more ego-driven. Bezos. You know, I think the amount of money being spent is just absolutely ludicrous and it is offensive. So I think that I'm sitting here listening to my town talk about taxes and like, you know, how are we going to fund the schools? And then you turn around and you see that. And it's like, I know that it's not tit for tat, but on the other hand, I think we can do better.
I'm kind of in the same boat. Like on one hand, just purely from a scientific perspective, we kind of need a hedge.
Yeah.
Like what if we get like an extinction level event, like a dinosaur killing sized asteroid hits Earth? Like right now, that's the end of humans. If we're also on Mars, hey, we've got a hedge. On the other hand, there does seem to be an awful lot of money being thrown around, possibly ego driven and not so much scientific exploration driven. But on the other hand, it's kind of like startups, like, you know, throw a bunch of them around. Maybe one of them succeeds. Maybe everyone gets interested in it. Like you said, it pulls together folks from different countries and walks of life to get behind one mission. So yeah, there's some good and some bad.
Yeah. I mean, that all said, obviously, were I given the choice of going to space, I would go in a heartbeat, right? Like there is no chance I wouldn't go. So if anyone wants to send me to space, I'm in.
All right. One space tourism ticket coming up.
Thanks.
So it looks like Starburst has been quite successful. I see that they're like tripling their customer base. They just raised $250 million on a $3.something billion valuation. You must be growing rapidly and hiring.
Yep. $3.35 billion. We are 3.35 unicorns. I will say that we joke that unicorns aren't real. That's actually not a joke. It's true. Sorry to say, but we treat ourselves as Clydesdales. We're workhorses. And part of our philosophy around that comes from the fact that when workhorses, individually, they can carry a lot of weight. But when you combine them, the sum is greater than the total of the parts. And like they can carry even more weight when they work together. And that's really our philosophy at Starburst. And we have a huge customer base and people are itching to get our software. And we launched Galaxy last year. We launched our data products offering this year. And our enterprise offering has been just blowing up, which is wonderful. We do need people to help us do that. So I would encourage anyone listening to join us. Like it's been a fun ride and it's going even higher. So it's very exciting. And we're hiring engineers, we're hiring product folks, marketing, sales, pretty much every organization, customer service.
All right. Well, we will be sure to include in the show notes a link to Colleen's LinkedIn profile, as well as the Starburst Data website where you can find those jobs.
Great. Thank you.
All right. Colleen, thank you so much for coming down and joining us and sharing your experiences with the listeners of Underserved.
Thanks so much for having me, Andrew.
And we'll talk to everyone soon on the next episode of Underserved.
Thank you for listening to the Underserved podcast. For more information on the topics discussed and for show notes, visit the show website, underserved.fm. And please be sure to rate, like, and subscribe to Underserved on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.